Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Welcome to New Books Network in Southeast Asian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nicole Corrado, Professor of Political Sociology at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the University of Canberra, Australia, and co-host of the channel. Today, I'm talking to Professor Baogang He of Deakin University. Baogang is one of the editors of Deliberative Democracy in Asia, published by Routledge in 2022. Together with Dr. Michael Breen and Professor James Fishkin, Professor Baogang He put together a collection of essays written by experts in the region to examine how deliberative institutions are promoted by national and local leaders, as well as urban and rural residents in Asia. Welcome, Baogang.
Yes, thank you, Nikos. Thank you.
Great. Baogang, for our listeners, I want to say that this book is very close to my heart because, like you, my work focuses on thinking about the prospects and challenges for deliberative democracy to take root in various parts of the world, particularly in my home country, the Philippines. And I would say this book is such a gift for many of us who are trying to envision the precise institutional configurations of deliberative democracy in countries that are often at risk of authoritarian consolidation and illiberalism. So thank you so much for putting forward such an important...
Well, thank you. Thank you for your wonderful chapters on the Philippines.
I didn't mean to self-promote my chapter, but thank you for setting up such an important intellectual agenda. But first, of course, we need to begin with definitions. And the book is entitled Deliberative Democracy in Asia. So in brief, can you please tell our listeners what you and your co-editors meant when you used the term deliberative democracy in your book?
Okay, thank you. So Albert Einstein once said that the three great forces rule the world. They are stupidity, fear, and greed. So in contrast, deliberative democracy holds the view that decision must be based on power of reason rather than political, economic, or military power. So the public deliberation and is the best weapon to against the collective or individual stupidity, fear, and greed. So deliberate democracy can be described or defined as an idea or approach that emphasizes the rule of deliberation among equals, that induce reflection, and that result in binding and legitimate decision. Deliberative democracy, in John Stuart Mill's language term, is a governance through the discussions where citizens become authors of collective decision that affects their life. So we can see, we have seen that there are a variety of forms of deliberative democracy, including like participatory budgeting, citizen jury, deliberative polling, which were widespread across the Asia country right now.
I'm glad you mentioned those examples of deliberative institutions, because many people, when they heard what you said, that deliberation is about reasoned discussion, it addresses our typical view of politics as about power and sometimes collective stupidity or unreason. Some people might think that, well, that is too ambitious, that is too ideal. Reality is very far from that ideal. So I think what's powerful about the book is you also provide a framework for building democratic or deliberative democratic institutions. So can you give us examples of how the principles of deliberative democracy are operationalized, so to speak, in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, in the book, there's a chapter on the Malaysia case. Professor Sunny, he talking about one of the examples, that is the Tamil Parliamentary Consultative Council, a sort of a people assembly, a grassroots parliament. So it was established in the local city in the Tamil. So it's aimed to have this kind of structured consultation. This council, this is they call People's Assembly, a grassroots parliament. They involve ordinary citizens, plus also a member of MP and some officials to discuss these common issues. They make the decision about the local issues. So the first meeting, the grassroots parliament, start with 70 citizens, then later increase to 150. So they are discuss a variety of issues, make the decision on the local public service issues. So this is probably the one example. Another example is there's a chapter by the Gary Loden talking about a case of our Singapore conversation. In terms of this scale, it's very impressive, the Singapore cases, but it's still fall short of criteria of deliberative democracy. But still, a can be seen example, try to apply the public deliberation to improve the public decision making process. So there's our Singapore conversation that involve like something that about 47,000 people, they had a 660 dialogue organized by the committee. And they spread across in Asia about 75 different locations. They are discussed the healthcare issue, housing issue, education issue, all the aging issues. So all those four issues are public issues, really impact Singapore daily life. One of the very impressive about Singapore, the way they organize those public forums, I observe them. They are extremely professional. They must hire some of the best expert in the world to advise them. And so how to organize. And they are, largely speaking, still consultative. That is, they submit a report to the government. Government adopt some of their policy recommendations. In terms of this 47,000 people attended, while the number is large, but it's still not representative. Another case probably we can say is probably, Nico, it's your chapter on the Philippines. You're talking about local development council. It can be advise the legislative body, and they will discuss the local issues and will be the best area to develop deliberative democracy. In your book, you mentioned Naga, a city of 200,000 people, and that is the best example of empowered civil societies. They are participate in post-authoritarian Philippines. So they have made some the people councils. They created the people council, created a mechanism for directly deliberative democracy by linking the public deliberation to formal space of decision-making. So this is probably this Naga city. As another example, in Philippines, they enrich the deliberation in local development councils. So that in Asian context, in Southeast Asian context, there's a variety of examples. And one of the examples, I think we in our book, we haven't mentioned it, is in Thailand. Actually, Thailand was quite early introduced deliberate polling instrument on the health issue. But because there are some agreement, so they cannot kind of publicly study that issue.
I've been reflecting on the examples that you gave us, particularly in, well, Malaysia and Singapore. And obviously, these are countries that don't really have the best reputation when it comes to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And then you give us examples of citizen dialogues and how these citizen dialogues are bridged to policymaking by the government. So how do you feel about criticisms that these deliberative processes are just being used as, let's say, deodorizers, right, of regimes to show that they are doing something democratic, but really the public sphere, for the most part, is still controlled by the state? How do you reconcile that? Or is that a creative tension that we should just acknowledge?
Yes, so in my work, I study China, so I come to a term called authoritarian deliberation. So this authoritarian deliberation also widespread in Southeast Asia. So some of the kind of semi-democracy or authoritarian states also increase use the deliberative forum to improve the decision-making process. So there are some the issues. But my view is that the public deliberation is a common contemporary trend in regard to what kind of regime, in whatever was a violation of human rights or freedom of speech. But to deliver the best, a good public decision, you need a sort of the modern technique. Like the deliberative polling, increase being used globally in more than 40 countries. So those technique mechanism can improve the government decisions, and it's kind of become the like the polling. Polling is become fashionable in many countries now to detect the public opinion. So deliberative polling also become an instrument for government to not only detect the public opinion, find out what the people want, but also offer citizens a little bit of space to articulate their voice, to impact their decision as a smart way to run the country. So the, in terms of the, I think this is probably in the features in the Southeast Asia, as well in East Asia. Public deliberation has already become a smart instrument for authoritarian renewal in a number of countries. So such a practice is likely to continue, even spread to other countries. So one of the intents of how, if we want to deepen democracy, Asian citizens need to work out a strategy to utilize deliberative institutions to challenge existing power relations.
That's very striking for me on how deliberative processes can actually also be tools of authoritarian renewal, right? It's not just a tool for democratization, but also reinforce existing.
In your article, one of your articles, you mentioned this sophistication of authoritarianism. And this authoritarian use of deliberate mechanism is one of the such examples.
That's a very important warning, Baogang. Thank you. Another critique put against deliberative democracy is that it is a Western construct inapplicable to contexts like Southeast Asia. These are countries with very particular histories, cultures, social hierarchies, and relationships. And I think when I was reading your book's introduction, it's very striking for me how you demonstrated how deliberative mechanisms in Southeast Asia are actually already based on traditions of public deliberation. So you cite the example of Indonesia that has a musyawara, which is one of the principles of Pancasila. Tell us more about this.
Before we go to the Master Wala, I should just come back to your early points that the deliberative democracy is criticized for being a Western construct. I don't think so. I think that deliberative democracy practice has a roots in the Asian tradition. So if we look at the history of democracy, consultative deliberative democracy take place much earlier than electoral democracy. And Islam has a long, long tradition of the consultation. So this Islam as a religion has deeply in this religious tradition, this engaged the consultation with the mass, with the people. So come back to this Indonesia, Musawala, the case. Musawala, the literature means discussions. So this notion is enshrined as a core principle in Pancasila national ideology. So starting in under the authoritarian government in 1980s, so the Indonesia military regime promoted the village deliberation, village election even, and promote this Musawalas. So the idea is that each year, beginning in the January, first at the village level, they have a discussion on the development plan. Then they will come to the district level, district city level in May, finally reach to the in August in the, at the national levels. And so at the village level, they have a developed a very impressive this kind of deliberations. And they have in particular, like infrastructure development. So each village receives a block ground from the government. How to use this ground? So then they invited the villages to discuss how to use it. So this kind of practice is deeply rooted in the religion's traditions and deeply rooted in the village life.
Yeah, that's really important to point out. Although I think one of the puzzles for many observers of these processes is whether these processes actually do make a difference. And if we actually take a step back further and think about the motivations of governments or powerful people to institutionalize this process, it's not immediately obvious, right? If the idea of rulers is to preserve power, what's the incentive to share power to the citizens? Why would the Malaysian government, why would the Singaporean government share power to the citizens? You mentioned a while ago that it has become a technology for smart governance. So what else did you discover in your book? Why do political regimes introduce public deliberation in the first place?
Yeah, we've been discussing the three mechanisms under which the power holder, they are forced to introduce deliberative democracy for the variety of reasons. So first one, deliberative mechanism can co-opt dissent and maintain social order. So say, take example, the establishment of our Singapore conversation, which I mentioned earlier. So the aim was to exclude or contain opposition voices. So People's Action Party had to deal with the shock 2011 election result, which is they decreased the percentage of vote. And the working class vote in particular had a look into opposition party, workers' party. So under these kind of circumstances, so in order to kind of contain the force of opposition party, they try to introduce this our Singapore conversation as a way to consolidate the PAP power. So in short, give a citizen a little bit of power in order to consolidate the ruling parties. So the second mechanism is that the deliberative mechanism can generate information about society and policy, and help to avoid mistake. So in the In the Malaysia case, as I mentioned, in the age of digital social media, every individual can be a journalist, publisher, and promote for the certain news. So it's difficult to control those social media. So under those kind of new conditions, Malaysia has to open up new channel to challenge existing hegemon. So Sunny, Professor Sunny, in his chapter discussed this quite well, because this is another new force the local government to explore the new way, as I said, build these grassroots institutions to address public concerns. The third mechanism is the open deliberative process can protect official from charge of corruption by increased credible transparency. So where the decision are difficult and always involves a conflict interest. So deliberative process enable leader to deflect responsibility onto the process and thus avoid the blame. So take example, as I mentioned, this village deliberation in 1980s in the Indonesia. So when the village receives a grant, a block grant from the government, how to use it? So if the government make a decision, you should do this, do that. But then sometimes it's not the people need. So then sometimes you invite the criticism or complain. So the best way, just let people to decide. When the people decide, whatever you decide, it's not my problem. It's because you make the problem, you make the decision. So this is a way, and then this is a way kind of to defect the official responsibility onto this deliberative process. And to, as I said, to avoid the blame. In the case of the Indonesia, so when they introduced this village deliberation, so the result is very impressive. So the village scale infrastructures, normally through those village deliberation process, was generally of a better quality, built more efficiently with less corruption than the equivalent infrastructure built by government or by contract. So there's obvious reason, because if you throw this deliberation, you really make a decision that is people need. And also when it comes to the implement stage, it's easy to do so.
I really enjoyed how you discussed that, because it's not like you're giving a bad story of deliberative democracy in Asia, right? It's not as if these processes are just instrumentalized by state actors and party actors to preserve power, but it also creates some room for voice. It's also rooted in Southeast Asian cultures, but can also be used for authoritarian ends. I think that's a very important nuance in our discussion, which challenges us, people who study deliberative democracy, to go beyond the good or bad categories of assessing deliberative democracy. Is it good for Asia? Is it bad for Asia? I think the nuance your book offers is very important. So I'm not sure if it's fair to ask you this question, but from your perspective, on balance, do mechanisms of deliberative democracy enhance the overall quality of democracy in Southeast Asia? Do they do more good than bad, or that is not a fair question at all?
Yeah, this is a really good question. First, I should say that when I read your chapter, and your chapter did offer us a very insight, the view that the deliberate democracy flourished in the period of uncertainty, from the revolutionary movement against colonialism to post-colonial nation building to an anti-dictatorship campaign to civil society-driven democratic innovation after People's Power Revolution. So you describe this in this as overlong period that really show us the deliberate democracy, or grassroots, this deliberate practice, is one of the driving force to deepen democratization in Philippines. But come back to your early question, the overall was a deliberate democracy practice enhance quality of democracy in Southeast Asia? I think when come to this issue, I should say there's several ways why the deliberate democracy can enhance quality of democracy. So there's several ways. First, they can address the deficiency of majoritarian electoral democracy. And deliberate democracy can improve and deepen participatory democracy. For example, in the form of participatory budgeting. And deliberate democracies, in particular, for example, deliberate polling can deal with disinformation and fake news successfully. But so those are potential, and they can do more. So if overall speaking, when I compare Southeast Asia with Northeast Asia, so the number of political experiment in deliberate democracy in Southeast Asia is much, much smaller than that of East Asia. So in Southeast Asia, probably we need to see more of those kind of experiments in a variety of form or area, like citizen jury, deliberate forum, grassroots parliament, and also like the Singapore's style of conversations. And so currently, I think that there's some the deliberative democracy practice, as I mentioned, there's several examples. But in terms of the number, it's smaller. Scale is happen at a village or local. But when it comes to national level, the only Singapore holds this one. But that Singapore is a city-state. So I think that it's too early to claim that the deliberate democracy has already successfully largely improved the quality of democracy in Southeast Asia. And we need time to test this hypothesis. There are some examples, sure, we can do that. It is successful. But we need a larger scale, more experiment. So this edited book, we really try to aim to promote this idea of deliberate democracy, draw some of the successful lessons so that Asian countries can learn each other, thus have a meaningful reshaping or enhance the quality of democracies.
Before we end, Baogang, I would like to take advantage of your presence in this podcast as one of the most eminent scholars of deliberative democracy in the region. I'd like to ask you about the future of deliberative scholarship in Southeast Asia. Where do you think is the field headed?
Yes, thank you. I mentioned this, just briefly mentioned, compare Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia. Kind of very little kind of dialogue between those two Asian regions. So I think that one of the future directions is we probably see more dialogue among the Asians itself, Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia, East Asia. And also the more dialogue between the political theorists and the Asian expert. And I think through this kind of interaction, cooperation and collaboration between the Western deliberative theorists, Asian study expert, or through the Asian citizen from the Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia. So probably we can produce a meaningful lesson policy recommendation that will be probably applicable across whole Asia. So that's probably the one direction. I think in the next 10 years, we will see more meaningful dialogue happen. The second new trends is already happened last year and this year. We increase the Asian become a part of global deliberation movement on the like climate issue, on the journal editing. So currently globally there's lots of global deliberation, global citizen forums on the climate issue, which happened last year, and Asian countries like India and China and many others, Asian citizens, has been randomly selected. They participate at the events. And we will see that this year or next year, there are more Asian countries were involved to become part of the Global Citizen Forum on the journal editing issue. So there will be very new, exciting experiment. And also, this is of Asian plays certain new contribution to global citizen deliberation. The third area that is a public is a new trends is what the scholar called the deliberative constitutionalism. So constitutionalism normally in the past involves a stakeholder, a political party behind the door, they engage in the negotiation, come to the deal, then they work out the new revised constitutions. So currently the trend is how to involve the citizen, public, in the revising constitutions. So we already see, even in Philippines, I was approached kind of maybe 2 years ago to facilitate or work with someone to develop a deliberate polling on the Philippines federalism issue. That must become, that is deal with the federal constitutions. So the president want to, when he was elected to president, and he want to kind of introduce a federal system in Philippines. So then this involves how the citizen involved. Unluckily, unfortunately, this did not happen yet. But the issue has been raised. I think that the issue was raised a few years ago. This kind of issue will be raised again in the Philippines. As well in Myanmar, I work with Michael Brain, my colleague, and we did some the deliberate forum on the federal constitution in Philippines. And in Japan, they are trying to revise the Article 9 of the constitution. So the one of the process is insert this public deliberation into the constitutional revision process. So this is a new trend. Deliberate democracy will increase play more important role in the constitution revision process. Another trend which we discussed earlier, that is a new trend, is both democracy and authoritarianism need a variety of form of public deliberation. So this authoritarian deliberation become a new challenge issue. How Asian citizens, on the one hand, needed to engage such practice for the purpose of democracy. At the same time, how try to reduce the level of the official control to push more into the citizens' openness, inclusiveness, and to address this what the Nicole in your writing mentions is sophistications of the authoritarianism. So what we said, when the citizen need upgrade its own instrument, become a citizen needed to be sophisticated in develop, push deliberate democracy. So we need to study this sophistication of the Asian citizen, along with to address this sophistication of authoritarianism. So those kind of four trends. Let me sum up those four trends. One is a kind of dialogue between among Asia, between Western deliberate theory and Asian experts, Asian expert. Second is that Asian become a part of global deliberations. Third is a deliberative constitutionalism. Third is to really citizens, Asian citizens, need to not only empower themselves, the citizen need to be smart enough, become more sophisticated to meet the challenge of authoritarian deliberations. Thank you.
That is a lot of work for scholars and practitioners of deliberative democracy in the region. Professor Bao Gang-he, thank you for joining us on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss deliberative democracy in Asia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This has been one of hundreds of conversations about other Southeast Asia-related books on the channel. You can download or stream these interviews free of charge from the New Books Network website or subscribe through your favorite podcast app.